supporters are seeking a similar response from the American public. The end goal of this approach is for a wholesale rejection of scholarship funded by Arab and Muslim endowment to be replaced by tried and trusted traditional vanguard ready to serve the purpose of empire at hand. Third, the attack would bring about a level of self-censorship and a pullback from funding controversial research. The internal discussion at each of the existing centers will most likely be impacted, and possibly a level of self-censorship develops, where particular type of research would not get the nod. As the debate and hearings heat up, each center will take a closer look at its programs and area of congressional concern will become more difficult to maintain. We are not speaking about an annual type of reviews, but a systematic examination motivated by external political consideration, the intent of which is to alter the content and scope of research undertaken. It is human nature to become cautious, and this often translates to distancing oneself from those areas that are considered problematic or a source of discomfort. Fourth, by attacking these endowments, the door can be made open to provide resources to offer counter-funding for, quote, legitimate scholarship, i.e., that which supports the goal of empire and clearly sympathetic to power. Every attack had a number of goals, and in this context, the effort is to bring about a demise of the existing paradigm in order to replace it with another more docile toward power and ready to march under the banner of new raw nationalism. What these individuals are looking for is summed up in the statement given in reference to the hearing for Title IV funding. Quote, where are the professors with a strong sense of national interest? Lots of knowledge in the field, good intelligence, connections, a willingness to recruit their students, and an eagerness to serve in times of war. As they lament, no such persons exist in the Middle Eastern studies. Dismantle the opposition and then conquer the terrain in academia, even though the intellectual arguments have long been lost, but who needs them if power is at your service? What we are seeing is a concerted effort at the fields of Middle Eastern studies, Arabic and Islamic studies, not for intellectual failures or success based on academic merits. On the contrary, the basic premise behind all of this is the lack of service to empire, not the quality of research itself. We are dealing with a much more difficult issue that has confronted scholars for centuries. What is the purpose of scholarship? For those scholars, captives of power, the obvious goal is to support the nation and its lofty aspirations at conquest and domination, which are needed to maintain, quote, society's progress and march. One can see that an argument for such purposeful scholarship can be readily made, but it would be a waste of our time to detail its finer points, for none I can find. The relationship between scholarship and power is as old as the human enterprise, and most likely will continue for the foreseeable future. However, for every awestruck scholar dancing at the foot of power, many a scholar labor for no other purpose than an interest in knowing more about something that he or she fell in love with and ready to forsake nights for sleep in its pursuits. The loftiness of a scholar's pursuit for the purpose of knowing is something that powers are often loath toward and ready to arrest. Through creating a siege mentality around Middle Eastern studies centers and Arab and Muslim funded programs in such a way that scholars' pursuit of knowing is arrested, and in its place, the awestruck scholars can come back to center stage to rationalize empire and bestow virtue on the naked emperor after everyone saw him naked in public. Thank you. Take questions now. Feel free to ask.
Right on your mic, bro. Blast away.
I don't think it doesn't work.
That's true.
I didn't hear it.
Except when it's buzzing.
Well, let's put it this way. They say Lawrence of Arabia. I often say Lawrence is not Arab. Lawrence is of Downing Street. He has nothing to do with the Arabs. He's not an Arab. He's a basic British spy. And literally, it was his idea to foment the Great Arab Revolt which was not great, nor was it Arab. It was also British in nature. He was instrumental in really setting up certain events in motion by going to the Hashemiyat in Mecca, Sharif Hussein. He had the idea that if he could encourage the Arabs to revolt against the Ottoman during the First World War, he would manage to cut the Ottoman forces right in the center. Considering that the Ottoman power was predominant in the Arabian provinces, and thus fomenting the revolt from the south through the Hashemiyat, the Sharif Hussein, would have been possible to attack the Ottoman forces and get the Ottoman to reshift their forces and to give attention to their southern flank, and thus allowing the British forces to land on the shore of Palestine and then also to come out of the south from Egypt. So Lawrence's idea, it was his idea to foment this revolt. Even some of the British intelligence service saw it as a far-fetched. When we speak of the Great Arab Revolt, you might think that these are mass numbers of Arabs who participated in the revolt. The total number of forces that were with Lawrence were between 300 to 500. And they were promised and given gold to participate in this revolt. There were far larger numbers of Arabs and Muslims that were fighting with the Ottoman against the British forces than those who revolted against it. But it was this revolt that attacked the Ottoman forces in the south, attacked the railroad, and really redirected some of the forces of the Ottoman, thus allowing Palestine landing of the British. Without this revolt fomented and attacking the railroad connection, it would have been a little bit more difficult, at least for the British, to do that. The second is that a revolt by the Sharif Hussein gave a signal to part of the British forces, because the British had Muslim forces in their troops coming from India, from South Africa, and they needed somebody with the credentials of a Sharif, meaning having the lineage of the Prophet, calling for this revolt as a sign that the British will actually bestow upon him the title of an Arab Caliph. So also to get a signal to those Muslim forces that were fighting with the British, without this revolt they would have turned against the British, or at least they would not have went into the battle as they have went without this indication. The British have been agitating for what's called an Arab Caliph, at least from the late 1800s. At one point they wanted to declare Muhammad Ali in Egypt as the Arab Caliph, but they had a problem. He wasn't Arab, he was Albanian. But I guess everybody names Muhammad must be an Arab. So racial profiling of the British empire at least existed at an early stage.
Well, what about the impression I have that he was sympathetic toward the Arabs and he was bitter about the British betrayal of Arab independence? That's a CBS version.
Well, the thing is that conflicts among colonial powers and colonial visions, it's something that exists. So he had a particular view of what he would like to see as he formulated his plan, and the British authorities or elite had a different perspective. They are still two perspectives that are external to the desires and aspirations of the people. Definitely there is a romanticism that is constructed around him, and that actually is post the period, actually 1930s and 40s, and mostly of Hollywood extraction, that they wanted to construct this Hollywood image of him, and that came out in post, I'd say 1930s, after his biography was written, a number of other writings. So Hollywood discovered him to romanticize the engagement with the Arabs. So that's at least it's something that I would say you can say that this was his initial participation. In another point of view, it is said that in his biography that he did have an Arab lover. So within his writing that he wanted to free the race as a gift to his lover, who was an Arab man in London. And he laments that when he went back to London, his lover was dead. So in some of the writing, he says that he wanted to offer a gift, and he saw that freeing the Arabs is an appropriate gift to his beloved. So once again, let's say, possibly freeing the Iraqis, some might be a gift for somebody's lover in Washington, D.C. We might discover that in 20 years from now. Berkeley had the question was about the response of the administration. Taking Colombia, which is the last attack, Colombia has been unfortunate because they actually went and set up an investigation committee to investigate the Middle East Studies program. And it was the setup of the hearing is just really very bizarre, because what they ask is that students come and testify to this committee about your feeling how you feel about your professor. And what you had is a line of students organized, as the case is, to come and give a litany of their feelings about their professors. And in particular is these four professors. Joseph Mas'ad is the major target, Hamid Dabashi also. Rashid Khalidi has been under attack from the time that he came and took the Edward Said's chair. They went after Colombia for actually instituting the chair, and because it received a portion of endowment from United Arab Emirates, a portion of the funding, not a considerable part of the funding. So there's been a campaign that this must it will produce softness on terrorism, and therefore the Edward Said's chair is somewhat illegitimate. So the university's approach is actually, rather than dealing with established structures within the academic circle where you have a peer review, so if there's a claim of bias from a student against a professor, it goes to an appropriate structure within the academic circle. There is an agreement, labor agreement, and so on. That was completely bypassed, and you have a structure that the president have set up, and there is an investigation of the professors. Based on this video that was developed by the David Project, selected a number of students giving their testimony about the intimidation that they face in the classroom with their professor in terms of Joseph Mas'ad in particular, which resulted in him canceling his class on Palestine this semester. So that's at least the response in Colombia. In Colorado, you already have the whole investigation right now, hearing at the state level. In New York, there's also hearings at the state level. The Governor Pataki is also on record condemning Colombia for its excesses and its former Middle East studies. And the New York Board of Education have already censored Rashid Al-Khalidi from participating in a teacher educational program, which has been going on for 10 years, and Colombia is part of it. So after they already had the invitation and he was online to participate, they dismissed his participation by a vote in the Columbia, in New York Board of Education. So you have that type of response. At Berkeley, the university, at least on the faculty level, issued a resolution that was also honored by the administration, that the university will actually defend professors for expressing their personal views, even in the classroom, as long as they don't ask the students that this will be the basis of their grade, that the faculty in the classroom can say, this is my personal opinion, and expressing their personal opinion, that the university will actually defend that right of the faculty to do so, as long as they don't ask the student to take it, and the grade is not based on that. So we have somewhat in here. But at the same time, we have a problematic case with the Novartis case, with Chapala, who was dumped out of the university. So the university has what you call principles, and then it has real principles. And the real principle is the bigger dollar sign. So in Novartis' case, the grant that the university manages in the School of Public Health is more important than the university. So in here, what you have is a mixed bag in here.
You had mentioned the intimidation of funding from Middle East to Arab Muslim sources. How serious has that been?
Well, it's very serious. There's many universities that are just rejecting taking any funding. I know a number of cases in here. For example, there was an endowment for a Turkish seat in Turkish language, $1 million, and the pressure on the university was mounted, and the university had to turn it back and not accept it. And now universities are thinking possibly 10 times before they take on endowment of Arabs and Muslims, because the insinuation that there must be some connection. And if it comes from overseas, it's even far more problematic in the sense. And this is individuals or governments. So there's many affluent Arabs, Muslims. Berkeley has a large number of Arabs and Muslims that graduated. In, let's say, in Saudi Arabia, there is an alumni, Muslim Alumni Association, or Saudi Alumni Association of UC Berkeley. Right? Because during the 70s and 80s, UC Berkeley used to have a program, a contract with the Saudi government, where Saudi students used to come into UC and study and then finish and go back. So they have a large number of graduates. And if Chancellor Tien went to Saudi Arabia, helped in formulating the association, and at least worked to try to get some of them to donate to Berkeley, and that should be credited for what he did in terms of seeking that source of funding. But now any source of funding that comes from the Arab and Muslim world has a big blood sign on it, that is blood money. So the blood libel is really connected to Arab and Muslim fund in a greater way, and there is hesitancy from institutions of higher learning to actually go after that. You're pretty much inviting headaches on the institutional level. The use of the Western feminism or feminism as a paradigm to attack the Arab and Muslim world as a way of furthering U.S. agenda. I always say that the war in Afghanistan was at least promoted by means of the burqa. It's the burqa that sold the war. Even at one point, you had congressional aides calling around Muslim organizations in Washington to see if they could borrow their burqa for a press conference, including our own in here, Boxer, was calling to try to see if they, because at one point they dressed women with burqas in the press conference to show the oppression in Afghanistan. And now there is no story about burqa anymore, and Afghan women are still wearing the burqa. And so it was a matter of generating the interest. Once again, there is oppression of women in the Arab and Muslim world. Wherever there is men and women, there is a level of oppression existing there. It exists not because of Islam, it's just because you have men and women. Right? That is the normative structure. But when we use it in relations to the Middle East and the Arab world, we think that we're dealing with some kind of pathology, and we try to find ways to explain it. So it must be Islam that's causing this repression. And my response is the following. Every 3 minutes we have a woman get raped in the United States. Is it because we have a large number of Muslims in this country? If that's the rationale, then what is the rationale? The rationale is that the society has a particular aspect to it that generates all these types of behavior, including battery, including type of oppression of women, including rape and so on. It exists in the Muslim world, it exists in many other places, but in here we use that as a way of advocating the agenda, as a way of promoting, because it casts us as being completely good or pure. We are the pinnacle of civilization, and they are the barbarians that need to be civilized. So once again, it's white man burden converged or articulated in new terminology, and not realizing that actually the white man has been the burden on the world for the past so many years, and we need to actually articulate it. So the women issue is one of in the forefront of how they deploy it for public relation purposes. You just look at the right wing, all these spokespersons of the right wing going and pontificating about women's rights, and you see the dirt that they have in their closets. You could fill whole stadiums with it, but then they stand there and then they pontificate about it. None other than Newt Gingrich going up and speak about women's rights. You would think that he's the advocate of feminism par excellence, not that he is the dirt from his previous marriages, right, could fill closets and closets. But this is this whole notion that's like, it's like master-slave narrative that is taking place on a global level. This, once again, is not a defense of Muslim societies or Arab societies. We have problems, right? That's not dissimilar to the normative in the rest of the world, right? And once again, people, when they want to deploy this issue, I say, if your house is made of glass, don't go around throwing stones at people. Don't complain or try to put this agenda that we're trying to show you how women needs to be treated while women in this country are still being given 70 cents on the dollar. If you get raped, most likely the person who raped you is not going to go to jail. It's going to be the legal system is going to find ways to get them off the legal process and so on. So once again, the learning process or this method of trying to teach or civilize the barbarian is a paradigm that existed in the 1500s and now is being articulated in a far more sophisticated Madison Avenue type of dynamics, and we need to be aware of it. You had your hand. That's the question. That's the big question. We have possibly considerable number of sophists and considerable number of practitioners, professional employees within the university. Nobody wants to put their head up because everybody's head is going to be chopped. If you don't know the university as a structure, it does not reward renegades. It does not reward rebels. It pushes them out, and there is many gatekeepers. And as such, one of the big gatekeepers is in relation to Israel. Gatekeepers are not, they're not going to let this question out to be debated out and openly. Every person who is a professor, assistant professor wants to be a professor, wants to be a chair of a department, wants to be an associate dean, wants to be a dean, and so forth and so forth. So everybody, by the time they're moving up, knows what is off-limits. And the off-limits is a lack of a discussion on this. Even, you know, you have somebody like, I'm not a fan of some of these individuals, but you have Zinni, who goes out and give a speech in West Point critiquing that this, he says that the worst kept secret in Washington, that the war in Iraq was for Israel. In West Point, it's not what you call, you say, a person out of the street. The next day, he's attacked as being anti-Semite, and all of a sudden, he's no longer in the front pages, nor he's being interviewed, because his critique is not an acceptable critique. So once again, this is a very, what you call, you have to have a thick skin to engage in this battle. And many of the intellectuals, they have mortgages to go after to pay. They have children in universities. And interest becomes a predominant way of evaluating where you are in your career. Would you like to stake your own career development on worrying about Israel and Palestine? Or would you like to pay your mortgage and pay for your kids? Most often people will go to the line of least resistance. So that's at least explain on the intellectual level why you have at least many who stay away from confronting this question.
Concerning Lebanon, I was wondering if you could provide some
context. Let me say this, and this might be shocking for people. I never supported Syria to go into Lebanon. Because when Syria went into Lebanon in 1975, it went to kill the Palestinians. And how Syria entered into Lebanon in 1975 is the following, and you could go into New York Times to follow the story. Syria sent a letter to Israel in 1975, carried by King Hussein, where Syria said to Israel that it will be in our best interest and your best interest for Syria to enter into Lebanon to prevent the coalition of Palestinian and Lebanese nationalists from winning the civil war in Lebanon. And Israel said that they will not interfere in Israel, in Syria's entrance into Lebanon. And thus you had the so-called Arab forces to enter into Lebanon. And the Syrian forces who entered into Lebanon besieged Palestinian refugee camps in Syria, went after the Palestinians in the camp, Tel Zatar camp, where hundreds and thousands of individuals got killed. And they were managed to reverse the balance of power on the side of the Meraniyat and the Falangists in 1975-76. And that's how they re-established the balance and asserting the balance that was still dominantly within the Falangists and the Maronites, who were allied with Israel at the time. And so Syria entry into Lebanon in 1975 had a regional and a global aspect to it. Israel was given a green light. The United States gave a green light to it. Also, the Arab world gave a green light, so the Saudis, if you want to really talk about Saudi Arabia, Saudis were funding the Falangists and the Maronites in 1975 against the Palestinians. The Jordanians and the Iraqis also were engaged in providing training to the Falangists and Maronites in 1975. Okay. Then after that, Syria began to play the balancing of power between the various components. Until Israel entering into the scene with its invasion, which is many invasions, invaded in 1978, invaded again in 1983. So Syria's presence in there, at least from its initial, has to be understood and to be known that it was an invitation bringing Syria in to preserve the status quo that was set up by the French in the 1930s based on a confessional basis. The president will be a Christian, the prime minister a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of the parliament is Shia. That was the French structure that they were set in 1930s based on a quasi-census that gave the majority of the Lebanese population to be Christian, thus giving them their presidency, even though that there hasn't been a census in Lebanon since the 1930s. Right? There hasn't been a census in there. So Syria, entry into Lebanon was in that dynamics. After the post-Israeli invasion, Israel was occupying the south, and it states that we will stay in the south Lebanon, which was not connected to Syria. It was connected to their war or their invasion of Lebanon to actually go after the PLO. Said that we'll not leave Lebanon until Syria leaves Lebanon. So once again, the Syrians were invited into Lebanon, the Israelis invaded Lebanon, but they were put at one and the other. Hezbollah, once again, because Syria now is being claimed to be supporter of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was born after Israel's invasion in 1985 as a result of Israel's atrocities in Lebanon. When Israel invaded Lebanon, the Shia were welcoming the Israeli troops. So if you go down the south and get some of the footage, the Shia were welcoming the Israeli troops in 1982-83 during that period. It was just a short period of time that changed into a resistance that resulted in evicting the Israelis out of South Lebanon. And Israelis are still occupying the area which is called the Sheba farms. So once again, 2 years ago when the Iraq campaign began, I said and I wrote about it, I said that Syria will be contained by creating tension with Lebanon. That's 2 years ago I said this, that Syria will be contained by creating tension through Lebanon, by encouraging the division that exists in Lebanese society and going after Syria by means of its troops that are present in there, because Syria, at least militarily, is no match to Israel, and Israel would like to contain Syria and prevent its alliance on the Lebanese scene by evicting it from Lebanon, and asserting once again its assets that are there, and the assets that the United States has with the Lebanese are considerable and long-standing. For example, many of the functionaries that are helping U.S. effort in Iraq come from the Falangist Maritime. The United States or Israel has no capacity to confront it militarily. Its military weaponry are, you can't even, in a garage sale in Russia, you might not even get them in discount. In 1981, when the Syrians' weapons were supposed to be very good, in one day they lost 80 planes to the Israeli Air Force. It was not because the Syrians, quote-unquote, are Arab and dumb, right? Because this notion is that the Arabs don't know how to fight, they're dumb. The reason is that the Syrians' plane have no radar, right? So the pilot is riding their plane and looking at the cockpit to see the plane, while the Israelis are equipped with the F-16 and AWACS, giving them all the coordinates, so an Israeli pilot can push the button from 50 miles away and he's shooting the Syrians' plane out of the sky, and 80 planes were downed in one day, in actually three days period, that the Syrian pilots refused to go in the plane because they're just going sitting duck. It's like fighting in World War II with planes that can't see beyond the window. So once again, when you write here in the New York Times, say the the heroism of the Israeli Air Force, once again is proven in the battlefield of the Middle East. 80 Syrian planes have been shot down in a matter of 3 days. They don't tell you the subtext, that by legal structure, the Syrians are not allowed to get weaponry that are up to par. And part of our own foreign policy, we always have to maintain Israel at a superior advantage toward each individual Arab nation and toward all the collective Arab nations combined. So when you have AWACS setting up in the sky, jamming the devices of the opposition, you have radar on your plane that could see it from miles and miles, it's not a matter of it's not a matter of fighting, it's not a matter of skill, it's just basic duck hunting. The duck doesn't have a radar to see where the NRA having an M16 or an AK-47 and thinks that he's actually hunting. If you really want to hunt, you go get a bow and arrow. At least there's some level of equality. But when you have an AK-47 and shooting at ducks, that is not really hunting in the classical sense. So this is part of the whole dynamics when we deal with the Syrians. So the Syrians are not going to confront, therefore they're going to withdraw. They were actually already giving the United States and Israel certain, what you call, tokens. For example, 3 months ago they allowed an assassination to take place in the middle of Damascus. Right? A major leader of the Islamic resistance was assassinated right in the middle of Damascus. Everybody in Damascus knows that the Syrian intelligence know wherever you go. It's like every cousin has somebody watching over them. And such a hit in the middle of Damascus would not have taken place without the Syrian intelligence forces looking the other way. And that was 3 months to show that they're ready to cooperate on terrorism, because the United States was putting pressure on them. They want at least to prevent an attack or some type of attack to take place. So the Syrians are going to withdraw because they're counting their ducks, and they know they don't have that many to confront the United States and Israel in this sense. And their presence in Lebanon was problematic from its inception. But the process by which it's being brought about is very problematic, and we need to be aware of it. So I'm not going to shed tears specifically on that question itself.
Any theory on the Hariri assassination?
Your call as my call, but I would say whoever done it has a very sophisticated equipment and know-how. The bomb was laid into the street, underneath the street. His car had very high technical equipment in it to jam any type of devices, but his car was completely ineffective in blocking the signals. So it means somebody who knew the type of communication structure that his car had, which seems that they had to have such advanced technical know-how to be able to do that. Second, the weapons or the bombs that used had completely melted his car. And his car is an armored car from the bottom and all around, designed specifically for his use, and it's melted, which means that the devices is much more than C4 type of explosives. The C4 type of explosive, there still his car would withstand it. It might have something more than C4 to have exploded the car. So these are aspects of the bombing that raises many questions of who is involved and who has the technical know-how. Definitely somebody that is just a week coming into Lebanon, into Beirut, would not be able to operate this. This is somebody who had assets on the ground for a considerable period of time. This would have been possibly a year or more in planning for it, to have already knew the map, the underground map, the layout of the street. He would have known his travel pattern, what time and all that. So all these details are there that we need to know about it. The fact that the Lebanese government has resigned is very problematic at this time, because this suspend actually the efficacy of the investigation, because there is no authority to actually put the investigation forward. So you had a period of time now until a government comes into the picture to actually constitute an investigation. And you know, every day leads gets lost, cleanup and so on. So by the time you have a government in place, what you call, all the evidence might be somewhere else, might be dumped already down the sea, and good luck going and following the track at that point. So it's very problematic at the time that it came. Well, why Syria? Well, you could say that Syria wants to be in Lebanon because Lebanon was part of Syria, at least what the basis is. All these states, from one perspective, are artificially made. You know, there was no such thing as a particular Syria with this border or a Lebanon with this border. I always say Sir Percy Cox had more to do with the maps of the Middle East and what passport you carry than any of the Arab countries themselves. So there's one aspect of Syria that they have irredentism toward Lebanon, that this is part of Syria. It's been cut off in the late 1800s when the French declared that they are the protectors of the Christian minority in Mount Lebanon and began to assert their right to intervene in the domestic affairs of Lebanon. This begins beginning in the 1830s and onward. And up to by the late 1800s, the French assert their right to actually separate Lebanon from Syria and declared an independent zone. So Syrian, at least from their perspective, that's what they assert. But the fact in the current context, it has more to do with balance of power within the Lebanese political map, that Syria wants to be there. And they see it as a way of trying to maintain some type of pressure on Israel through Lebanon by means of rediverting, rather than confronting Israel on their own territory, to confront Israel at the Lebanese territory. So that's at least from their strategic point of view. On war and strategy, because you have to deal with India, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, the United States, dominance of power. So that's a whole class that we need to. Even the Middle East. When we talk about the Middle East, we're talking about what part? What is the Middle East? What constitutes the Middle East? Is there such a notion? The Arab world. Where is the Arab world boundaries? And we can't discuss this without discussing oil. Is the United States and the world ready to stop its addiction to oil? Is our governor going to sell his SUVs and drive a hybrid, right? A VW or something. So it boils down to resources. So we're addicted to oil. We're going to be in the Middle East. And then if you speak about global economic competition, not Pakistan, but you have China on the one hand and Europe. So there's a competition in there. If I'm in Pakistan, I would be worried more about India than Iran, because still the project on the Indian front is as much as important as what's taking place in Iran next door.
I don't think I'm too worried about Iran. I'm saying the kind of flow of.
This is part of the power and empire, you know. It's all this is, I consider it to be Madison Fifth Avenue advertisement campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, now the new product that we're selling is Iran.
Yeah.
Right? This is the new product. Mm-hmm. And once again, I already began to speak about Iran last year, that this is the new target. I said it's either Iran and Syria, and my belief that Syria would be contained through Lebanon. And Iran will be the target to be confronted because of the possibility of nuclear weapons. So now we have all the configuration in Washington. Every day is speaking about Iran. Now they're going to build what you call the threat level. It's what you call basic psychological game that you have. So we're going to go to the United Nations. We're going to ask a resolution that Iran need to dismantle its nuclear program. And we need to give her, what is it, the resolution, maybe 1559 is applicable to Syria. Maybe we'll get to 1661 or 1662 and so on, that Iran should be disarmed of its nuclear weapons in 3 months or 6 months. And we begin that process, and you escalate the threat, you escalate the sanctions against Iran. It's a pariah state, and to legitimate a policy already been chosen. Okay, that's what we need. The policy has already been articulated, at least in my reading of the neoconservative writing vis-a-vis United States' role in the Middle East. Now, how to sell it to the American public? So the American public need to be what you call psyched up. Just like you psych them up for a Super Bowl, you need to psych them up for a new confrontation toward Iran. Is the threat, and you have to begin to think that Iran is next door, next thing is going to be invading America, like Grenada was about to invade the United States at one point, or Nicaragua. And this becomes spoon-fed. And individuals, at least, people are still basically are susceptible to the advertisement campaign. You know, why do people buy Nike? Why is it that people want to have this line on their chest? Right? If anything, it's antithetical to capitalism. Right? Why would you like to wear a hat that has the sign of a company that's not paying you to wear it? Right? Basic capitalist discourse would be if you're providing a service to somebody, you should be paid. So if you're wearing the hat of Nike, you should ask them for royalty rather than charging you for it. But actually, you have been so susceptible to advertisement, so susceptible to being what you call a commodity or a product, that you buy it without even thinking otherwise. So the new product that we're selling is Iran. And from now until possibly whatever formulation of the implementation of a policy, all the discussion is going to be about Iran, so much so that possibly people will forget about Iraq. Because if you notice, most of the news are still not that much in Iraq, except when there's an explosion that's taken place. The new product, right? Iraq was last year. Now is the new improved product. The new improved product is Iran. Just like when you have shampoo, there's a new improved shampoo that takes your dandruff off. So now we have a new improved product called Iran. And if we attack Iran, we'll promise you you'll be safe. Once again, it's the emperor telling you you'll be safe. Just give me the opportunity to do what I need to do. Just go and get a bunch of more threatening menaces out there, and you'll be secure forever after. A fairy tale, and if you believe it, then you fell for the what you call the quickest sell of the century for another time again.
Huh?
For the next 15 years, we're on a course of conflict. Even if a Democrat comes into the White House, right, because many of people are hoping that a Democrat might be elected. If a Democrat gets elected, he does not want to be called what you call weak and spineless and against the military. So all of a sudden, he has to prove that he is tough and strong and he is pro-military. If you realize, when you look at Vietnam, Vietnam was not undertaken by the Democrats, by the Republicans. We had Democratic presidents who were there. Kennedy was a Democrat. Johnson was a Democrat. And then we had Nixon, who was lying as the process. He said, I want to get you out of Vietnam, but took us so many years after carpet bombing Kampuchea as a way of trying to get out with saving face. So if a Democrat even comes into the office, don't celebrate and go back home and think that we have somebody in there that's going to take us into a course of peaceful existence. He still will maintain a forward-looking militarism in the Middle East, because he's not going to withdraw, because immediately he has to begin think about a second term, and a second term he doesn't want to be seen as being weak on defense. Right? So for the next 15 years, we're in a course of conflict. How is going to end? Anybody's luck. But I could tell you that empires' projects are expensive, and they often lead to a dead end and a detour. And this is for sure. How is going to happen? What will be the equilibrium? What will be the turning point? It's anybody's guess. The dynamics that I see unfolding, it will take some time. Even if the United States, let's say tomorrow, said it's going to extricate itself out of Iraq, it'll take about 3 years just to get itself out in a systematic way. Getting out of Iraq will mean also getting out all of the economic infrastructure that we have built, because we already have owned almost everything in Iraq. We've been selling Iraq down the drain from the moment that Bremer came into the picture. So extricating ourselves from there also in the economic picture means that much more. Removing or attempting to move out will create also internal dynamics of confrontation in most of the places in revolutions, as well as in power vacuums. You will have this process. So withdrawing or calling for withdrawal is not going to end up being in 3 years. It's going to be more. If we say we're going to withdraw, what does that withdrawal mean? Are we going to withdraw from Jordan, where we have troops, special forces? Is it going to mean that we're going to withdraw from Qatar, which is our forward base right now? Kuwait, half of the country is already taken as a military zone for the U.S. forces. Bahrain, likewise. So it's not as easy. In Arabic, we say entering the bathroom is not like getting out of it. So my formulation, even if we have the intent domestically and the support domestically to get out of there, it will take time to get out. And my estimation that 15 years is a conservative estimate for the chaos that still is unfolding. We're still not even beginning process of the chaos that is unfolding in the region. They say the supporters of Israel, do they make any distinction between supporters supporting Democrats and Republicans? Actually, if you look at the Israel lobby in this country, they're actually support what you call equal opportunity, in the sense they support both Democrats and Republicans as long as they show their support to Israel. So there's a A considerable part of the Jewish community versus organized pro-Israel segments, and I differentiate. Many of the Jewish community is unorganized, right? Jews who are not organized into the core of the Israel supporters. Israel supporters will split their vote and split their donations, which is far more indicator of the intention of the community, of the pro-Israel community versus the Jewish community itself. Historically, the Jewish community allied itself with the Democratic Party. The pro-Israel forces align themselves with both parties in terms of donation. 50% of their donations goes to Democrat, and almost 50% of their donations goes to Republican. Sometimes there are far more leverage that is given to the sitting president and the power in the Congress and Senate. So if the Republicans are ahead, you will see that their donation in that direction will go increase a little bit. So that's where the differentiation has to be made.
Now, you mentioned Iran before. One of the new factors that is apparently coming to play is this creation of an Iranian oil exchange, possibly, maybe by the end of this year. And there are a couple of people who are supposedly to know that anticipate there could possibly be war with Iran by June of this year, maybe by Christmas.
There are some, at least Haaretz have written on the subject in the Israeli press, a possible attack occurring by June on the nuclear facilities of Iran. So in the Israeli press, there's a discussion of it. Some go as far as saying that actually the Israelis will take that hit, considering that Israel has been provided by 500 bunker buster bombs last year. So there's that discussion. Cheney, in a speech, already said that I wouldn't be surprised in an off-cuff statement that if Israel does it. So in here, this is what I consider preparing public opinion, because you need to test the ground to see how public opinion actually is receptive or not receptive, and you test these in terms of public opinion. There's that possibility. It's been discussed, and I wouldn't see it. It's something that is beyond the scope. An American public opinion, I would say, is already decisively anti-Iranian. And I would say if you just show the movie Not Without My Daughter, you play it a couple of times on a prime time zone, you put it on Fox and you have discussions, then you have a 20th or 30th anniversary of the hostages and you get Ted Koppel with his authoritative voice speaking about the hostage situation and so on. You run a few of these episode documentaries, and then you begin to run the polling, and then you just make the coverage. I would say the American public will already be, I don't know, I think they're already 63% in a poll that I saw would support some type of attack on Iran if it does not dismantle its nuclear forces. We did not even have yet the what you call the public relations campaign in a real sense, and you already have 63% support for it. So I wouldn't be surprised. And definitely you'll have a few, once again, deploying the woman issue, saying women are oppressed in Iran, so we're going to liberate them. And you also intertwined it with the nuclear weapons, at least.
It would seem that Israel is being set up to do it, with Cheney and Bush both having said something about it, and the guarantee that both political parties, say war parties, would both applaud, whereas the United States would do it, that element of the Shia in Iraq that the United States is trying to curry, that also is tied to Iran, that whole thing might come apart and a whole different resistance might develop in Iraq, and I don't think the United States would want to chance that, and if Israel is going to do it, to get all the applause from the West, from the United States, I don't think Iran would really retaliate right away.
With what they're going to retaliate? Yeah, that's why somebody said that Iran is threatening to retaliate. With what?
Exactly.
They have second-tier Scud missiles without guided system, the same ones that the Iraqis had during the first Gulf War. They have what's called Shihab 1 and Shihab 2, held on by the Koreans to develop. Likewise, it's a blind rocket. You launch it and lob it. It goes 1,500, and you don't know where it's going to hit. Aside from that, all their air force is inferior technology. And if you read some of the Iranian material, they're actually planning asymmetrical warfare. So their response is not going to be in terms of symmetry, but asymmetrical, meaning that they know that they have inferior technology and inferior confrontation, both with Israel and the United States, so they will opt for an asymmetrical confrontation. And my expectation that their response would be in targeting the Strait of Hormuz by at least stopping the shipment of oil, targeting the oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, and then using their assets in some other places, including possibly the Bab al-Mandeb, which is the southern tip of the Red Sea, and other activities as well, to engage in as much chaos militarily facing a superior power that will is heavily dependent. So that's at least what the Iranians would be responding if an attack occurs. But I don't see them actually being able to confront in a symmetrical type of confrontation.
But aside from that, I mean, there's a whole economic element to this. And going back to the whole point about the oil exchange, basically what it was written about the threat that this would have, this would present to two or three large oil exchanges now, which currently still trade on dollars, and that this eventually, that this Iranian exchange would be a euro.
Euro-dominated. The Venezuelans are interested in it. So there is a number of discussions about it. But that's where you have one element of the economy, whether that can materialize, which explains why we're going after Chavez, a duly elected, democratically elected president. We love democracy as long as it doesn't bring the wrong president, right, in our view. So we want democracy as long as we choose the person who gets elected and signs on the dotted line. So we're going after Chavez. Iran and Chavez are thinking about this. There's some others. But I don't think that can happen with the Arab oil-producing countries that are dead against it. The Saudis are not going to play it, and they're the major dominant player.
Well, supposedly the word was because of the souring relationship to the United States, they might be interested in it. But,
yeah, the Saudis are not gonna jump. Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait. So it basically would be possibly two or three countries. Libya is interested, Venezuela and Iran. Aside from that, really you don't have a full functioning exchange. But it's an interesting idea. Yeah. We'll go up there.
I was wondering, back to embedded intellectuals, if there's any...
For academic freedom that is beginning to contemplate. We have a number of people. That's a committee that is set up. We're beginning to set up, to actually offer some type of grant for student organizations that apply. We have 11 applications for a grant. It's a $500 grant that we give to student organizations to organize on campuses. We're also beginning to investigate the legal aspect. You remember when we filed in San Francisco State, we filed not a lawsuit, but a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights, Office of the Department of Education, federally. Ocean Numa was one of the lawyers. So we're also thinking to see if there are some legal discussions that we could actually file for some type of a legal action of harassment, intimidation, and violating of civil rights of professors and faculty on the universities, and file it with the Department of Education, as well as try to see if we could muster some legal muscle to see if we could file it into an actual lawsuit. It's in the initial stages. We're going to talk to the ACLU, National Lawyers Guild, and others to see if that's the possibility. Even if, as an organizing tool, it has its value as well, that using the legal muscle with a political campaign simultaneously. So I was 2 weeks ago, I was in Colombia, talking with the students and discussing the same type of topic and how to respond to some of the attacks that are there. So there is some network that is developing. And yesterday, Carlos Munoz sent out a petition for World Churchill. We already have 217 faculty that signed in support of his academic freedom and calling for the university to back off and to adhere to standing principles of academic freedom that's been in existence at least from the early 1920s. So there is positive movement at that end as well. But I think it needs to far more crystallize into an actual stronger campaign touching many aspects of the universities. And they need to harness the resources of the society for that confrontation and that war. I think this is just to try to get people to commit for that long, but I can't see it lasting that long. At the ultimate end, we are fighting a war on a credit card. That's basically, at least in the 60s, when the Vietnam War began, we were not in debt. The debt that we acquired was in the post on the later period of the Vietnam, and the debt was still manageable in that sense. And now I don't see, you know, we're going to spend another $80 billion in this current appropriation. The defense budget is $419 billion, and this is for defense aside from the Iraq outlay, which would require $80 billion, which I don't think it's going to last that long if the Iraq situation continues to increase. I don't think there's enough money for another appropriation in about a year period, considering the rate that we are going through in terms of the debt that we're acquiring. China is mostly, and Japan, England, and Germany are funding our deficit. And I would say the Chinese essentially are working possibly with the Sun Tzu approach of war. Let your enemy spend their way into demise while you're undertaking engaging in business and expanding your industrial base. And at the end of the day, the U.S. industrial base is already have left the country. It's in China. Even the service sector is already leaving the country faster than people can keep it. Many of the Silicon Valley companies are no longer operating in the Silicon Valley. There is a shell in Silicon Valley, and much of the production is taking place overseas. For example, UC Berkeley medical records are managed by a company in Pakistan. It was contracted to a company in Florida, and the Florida company subcontracted to a Pakistani company, and therefore our records are managed, medical records are managed by a Pakistani company. So, therefore, if you look across the spectrum, that is the case in many other areas in terms of our economy. And China is producing considerably most of our commodities. And I often say, when you buy gifts for Halloween or for Valentine's Day or Christmas, you're buying Chinese-made manufacturing. You're not buying M1 or F-16, right? So even the project for expansion and preemption that the U.S. is formulating, it has a considerable economic weaknesses in it that it cannot be sustained for a long period of time. And it only could be sustained by enormous expansion of the economy. And I can't see this rate occurring. Last year we expanded by 3.5 or 3.8 expansion. It would require greater expansion than that to maintain. And most of the expansion was not really based on domestic increases in employment or job. It's rather the rate of expansion in profits that contributed to the bottom line within the economy. So at least from that perspective, I don't think we could sustain it for a long period of time.
Before we might have to wrap up, if you care to, can you say anything about the Iraqi election, since that's a very timely topic?
Well, the Iraqi election, like the Vietnam election, was celebrated by a high margin of approval. In Vietnam, it was 83% approval or 83% success rate in 1967. So likewise, I'm not surprised that you have a success rate in Iraq. The problem in Iraq has not yet begun. Really, still, the question in Iraq has not begun yet. How is it going to be settled between the various communities in there? Will the Kurds have a state in the north? What kind of state? Federal state. What are its boundaries? What is its right to its economic resources? The Kurds in the north are confronted with the Turkish power, or the power of Turkey, who already has Turkish minority in Iraq. They're the Turkic community, which Turkey already has forces. It has 15,000 forces in the northern part of Iraq. Turkey is not going to allow this to happen. No matter what the United States calls for, its own survival and the cohesion of its boundaries is far more important to Turkey than what occurs in the north in terms of the Kurds. So that's one question that nobody has yet settled. In the constitution that was drafted by Noah Feldman for Iraq, right, it says that each group will have a veto power, meaning that you are going to create a constant shift of alliances and their alliances could be maintained only with the presence of U.S. troops on the scene, thus continue having a point of friction between the various forces. In terms of the Shia, if the Shia are right now, supposedly they're going to lead the government, the Shia are slowly going to move toward an Islamic state. Whether it's de facto or de jure, that's where the aspiration is. Rumsfeld already on record, that's not going to happen, right, in his press conference. That's not going to happen with his hand like this, right? So that's another point of confrontation. The Shia in Iraq will be far more allied with the Shia in Iran, just based on historical links and relations. So what will be the dynamics in there? What limits we will institute? Not to say about the Sunnis, they're still outside the political process altogether. Then there is the monarchist part of the question where nobody have actually began to discuss. The monarchists are the old Hashemite who used to rule over Iraq, and they were actually asking for a constitutional monarchy to be formulated. I bet you from the Jordanian side, the Jordanians want to play a role because they see that as their legitimate territory, that they were stripped from it in 1958 when the Iraqis had the revolution. So that's still in there as part of the equation on the scene in Iraq. And this is assuming that no other hands are playing into the pot. I would say there's many hands that are playing inside the Iraq. I wouldn't put some of the other Arab governments. For example, and I'm not saying if you're a Saudi Arabian government that is under pressure, what is the best way for you to actually say that the current project is not going towards success? Covertly, you support the resistance inside Iraq. Right? To maintain the pressure, to say that we are your trusted allies, so covertly you support and engage. And this is not an attempt to once again engage in critique of Saudi Arabia, but this is a possibility as a way of engaging in this type of critique.
What's the place for Chalabi and Alawi, if any?
We don't know what role. They will play a role on the scene. Chalabi was our man, right? It seems that his stock goes up and down depending on the period, just like the NASDAQ. but, you know, what type of, whether he's going to be in or out, he's definitely is a person that's been around. His family has long history of being of service. His father was of service to the British. He was a functionary of the British when the British were ruling over Iraq. So his family has a long-standing relations with the British throne, and he inherited at least some of those dynamics, thus building his base in London when he went into exile. But I think he's selling himself as a middleman that could actually bring or strike deals with a variety of different areas, and I wouldn't be surprised that he would gain some foot in some capacity in the government to be.
Excuse me for extending the point. I, as a layperson, was surprised that he was back. After all, isn't the person that the American government and media said was selling secrets to Iraq?
Now, when Chalabi was attacked, Richard Pearl was on TV defending him. Okay. And the neoconservative put a full press on the media. If you notice, the story dropped.